Good morning, everybody. Have you been outside? Should I say Merry Christmas, everybody? Can't wait to cozy up in front of a Hallmark movie this afternoon. My name is Dan. It's my honor to serve as pastor here this morning. We're going to talk through Luke chapter 14. You can take notes on a hard copy there. We also have notes available to you in our app. We have a church app. Go get it. Look at the tab that says, the button that says Sunday Mornings. And when you click on that Sunday Mornings button, you can get right to our digital version of our notes and then email them to yourself and keep them and study them forever. So you're welcome. Luke chapter 14, here's where we're going today. Jesus is talking to us, and he's telling us something so vital, specifically the people who really, really like Jesus. There are some people that have gathered around Jesus in what's described as a large crowd. He has lots of fans. He's become a celebrity. There's a lot of hope and expectations that Jesus is going to kind of come through for them. And Jesus says to them something very, very hard. I hope you're ready to hear something hard today. Are you ready to hear some hard stuff today? It is not fun. When I prepare messages like this, I'm like, come on, give me something fun. I want lots of exciting good news. And we get good news, but it is challenging today. And here's where we're going today. You'll see it in the big idea. You can't be a disciple. Basically, you might say, now, Pastor, I've done a little public speaking, and when you're trying to motivate people, you make it positive. You don't say things like you can't, or you won't, or you never, or whatever. But the reason it says you can't is because it's the way that Jesus describes what it looks like to follow him in this text. So we have 10 verses of Jesus basically saying, you can't do that. You cannot do that. And here's where we're headed today. You can't be a disciple, which means a learner, follower of Jesus, if you do not carry your own cross. So there's this metaphor that Jesus uses to teach what it takes to be a follower of Jesus, someone who's learning, someone who's growing. I have been, I'm on my second phase of financial aid forms for my second child, headed off to college soon, and I'm working through my second set of financial aid forms, and a part of that whole process is to link over to all of the scholarships that are available. And I learned the hard way that just because there's a big list of scholarships advertising that they're willing and able to give you $5,000 all the way up to $20,000, it doesn't mean they really mean it. What I mean by that is I have found myself naturally gravitating towards those links in the list of scholarships available that are big money, big payout. And only recently have I discovered that the big money, big payout links bring you to applications that basically ask for you to give away everything you own, everything you have, including your social security numbers and all of your firstborn children, in order to qualify. And some of them say, we will now enter you to qualify. And I have instinctively avoided the links that offer a few hundred bucks. When you compare it to what it costs to be in a college or to get a college education, and then you line that up with, we're going to offer you a few hundred bucks. But here's what I've noticed. The ones that only offer a few hundred bucks are quick and easy applications. The ones that promise a big payoff require a lot of time, a lot of energy, and my daughter has to type essays and then, like I said, hand over things that belong to her and so on. And instinctively, I recognize that if I want a big money payout, it requires big investment, lots of time. It requires some sacrifice. And we think about this kind of transaction all the time. And some of you may have been involved with, come across, or somehow are aware of some of the ways that network marketing startup businesses are. So you might have come across network marketing where to get involved in a network marketing company, there's low thresholds. It doesn't cost very much. Some of them free, some of them an easy sign up, and then you become a part of the company. Then it suddenly, you start to realize over time that to belong to the company doesn't cost very much, but to be successful in the company costs a lot. You got to buy your own inventory kit. You got to pay all kinds of whatever kinds of fees and so on. And then you discover, oh, the people who are really successful have actually invested a lot. And what Jesus is going on to teach here is this, is that for lots of learning, lots of growing, lots of changing and deep roots, it doesn't happen without massive sacrifice and lots of effort. That, in fact, much like anybody, I mean, this happens to us instinctively. Even when we say to our church family, hey, there's some opportunities to volunteer, to give and serve, one of the first questions that people tend to ask us, which is a great question, is what kind of time is needed or required? What kind of investment do I give? How much do I have to give in terms of time and effort compared to what I'm going to receive, the impact I'm going to make? And we face these kinds of questions about what we're going to do with our time and energy, availability, what will it cost me, how much time do I have to give all the time? Here's the thing. In the Christian faith, when you're following Jesus, we don't get to determine what the criteria is. We don't follow Jesus on our terms. He doesn't let that happen. He defines the terms for us. And so when we're making arrangements to follow Jesus, we have to recognize that Jesus teaches that if anyone follows him on their own terms and brings to Jesus their own agenda, they're not really followers. And this is what was happening in Luke chapter 14. It starts by saying, and Jesus basically spoke to the large crowd who was full of fans, who said, this guy's a real celebrity, and if you stick with him, we're, number one, he feeds people. Number two, it's quite possible that if he rises to power and we're with him, we're going to get to enjoy some of the power and pleasure related to being associated with the new leader. And the large crowds were devoted to Jesus, marveling at what he said and did, with some level of hope that it's going to pay off for them. So if you stick with Jesus, you end up in power. If you stick with Jesus, you end up receiving some of the pleasures that power brings or that your political power brings. Little did they know that Jesus, as they followed him, that Jesus was actually walking towards his own cross and crucifixion. Little did they know that the disciples, 11 out of the 12 of them who were following Jesus, their lives were going to eventually end in murder and martyrdom and some of them being tortured to death. 11 out of 12. John is the only one that we believe, historians believe, didn't die some horrible death, and he died by natural causes. But the large crowd doesn't know this. They don't know Jesus is headed to the cross and that the disciples are headed to their own miserable destruction by following Jesus. So Jesus tells these stories, and in his teaching, he basically says, don't be a fool. Don't be a fool when you think about following me. What you're experiencing now in these large crowds is not what's required to follow me. Jesus actually says, receiving me is free. Putting your faith in me is free. The gift of salvation, free. You don't have to do anything to be saved. You believe. And then there's this kind of belief that moves you into following me. And to follow me and to grow and to change and to bear fruit and to deepen your life and to experience all the things that I have for you requires more than saving faith. You actually have to commit yourself to something big. Don't be a fool. And then Jesus tells the story about two specific kinds of people. It's a builder, and he says this builder was such a fool because who would ever be able to handle the embarrassment of starting to build a tower? Jesus is probably teaching here about building a vineyard tower, which allows someone to tend their vineyards by going up to the top of the tower and being able to see and oversee their the land that they own. And he's describing that there's this level of embarrassment over the foolish person that starts building the tower and then halfway through discovers, I don't have the resources to finish. And now every day there's a public reminder and everybody gets to see that some knucklehead across the street started to build and then never actually added up the cost and somehow got halfway through the building and then realized, I don't have what it costs. So never mind. And there it is, halfway built. And Jesus said, don't be foolish. Don't get yourself in that situation where before you follow me, you don't, or you fail to consider the cross, the cost. And then he describes this king, and he says, then there's this, don't be the foolish king who, before sending his troops to battle, fails to count how many enemy soldiers and troops there are versus how many they're sending into battle. What a foolish king to send all of his army off into battle without considering the fact that there's way more enemy, that he doesn't have enough to win a battle, and the embarrassment and the foolishness of somebody to not be able to finish because they didn't consider what was required to win or to build. And Jesus, using this kind of line of thinking, basically describes what it's going to take to be with him, stay with him, follow him, to grow, bear fruit, and be a vibrant disciple. I remember having this kind of proposal put to us way back in high school. Every spring, there was baseball tryouts at Liverpool High School, and about 130 high school boys would show up at the field. Oftentimes in the spring, it looked like it does outside now. It looks like Christmas. And we'd get our baseball gloves and go out and try out. And something always kind of caught my attention. That is, the first few days of tryouts, the coaches were very, very specific and very bold to say this to everybody who was trying out. Boys, keep in mind that while you're trying out, if you and your family are taking a vacation on spring break, you don't have to come back tomorrow. In other words, if you're going to be away with your family during spring break, don't bother trying out. And what they intended to say at the time, that sounded crazy. I'd be like, who would ever give up Mickey Mouse for this terrible coach? Who? And what I realized later on is that what the coach was saying is, we intend to compete on a level in which we're going to win championships and titles and tournaments and sectional championships, and we're going to win the states. It's easy to get on the team, but what it takes to win is so much more. And we're going to get out there and we're going to compete to win. And we already know what it takes. What it takes is you have to give up your week of vacation. And I used to think crazy things like, nobody's going to do that. And turns out everybody did that. Everybody gave up the week to make the team and to win. What was the motive? The motive was, I want to be a part of a successful, thriving championship team. And here's what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying, I am going to win. I'm going to help you win. I'm going to help you thrive in your life, grow, bear fruit, put your roots down. But it doesn't happen with some weak, lighthearted, half-hearted devotion. It's going to require so much more. And Jesus describes what that means here when he gets to the when he gets to answering this question. I want to follow Jesus, but I want to know, what does that even mean? Where do I begin? So Jesus is addressing the large crowd, and he says to them, here's what it takes to follow me. Here's where you would begin. And in the Christian faith, you can't change and grow without max investment. We're going to see that this is what Jesus teaches. Here's what he says. He says, you cannot be one of my disciples. And here in verses 26, 27, and 33, listen to this. He says, if you want to be my disciple, if you want to be my disciple, then, he goes on to say at the end of verse 26, you need to do this, and you cannot be my disciple. Verse 27, he says, you cannot be my disciple. Verse 33, he says, so you cannot become my disciple. See how he starts? He says, here's how you cannot become my disciple. You cannot be my disciple unless you first consider the cost. Consider, think about the personal cost to you. In verses 26 and verse 23, here's what Jesus says. He says, if you want to be my disciple, you must, by comparison, hate everyone else, your father, your mother, wife, children, brothers, and sisters, yes, even your own life. Otherwise, you cannot be my disciple. And then he goes on to verse 33 and explains again, you cannot be my disciple without giving up everything you own. So can I summarize this for you? You can't be my disciple unless you hate everyone and give up everything. Now, if you're a critic of the Christian faith, here's what you do. You take this out of context and you say, you want to know how crazy the Christian faith is? Their main hero, their main leader, their main rescuer, the Christ in Christian, says that you have to hate your own family. Now, how many of you would raise your hand and admit, Pastor Ned, that's a little insane. If someone told me that Jesus believed that, I would say, that's, people who follow Jesus are a little insane. Nobody, am I the only one? That's crazy. But that's why you have to know context. You have to look for insight and say, what's literal? What's metaphor? And here's what Jesus is teaching. And there's this little two words I want you to see that are so vital in this passage, and it basically says this: by comparison. And what Jesus is saying is that no one can be my disciple except that by comparison, their love, devotion, affection, and their trust in treasuring me is so big and so great and so massive that in comparison, it seems like they love their own family less, that they desire them less. In some cases, it's perceived that they're disregarding them altogether. So I hate everyone and give up everything in comparison to the way that I desire and love Jesus. That my love as a disciple for Jesus is so great that the best earthly loves looks like hatred. The best earthly loves by comparison for the things that I own looks like I despise them in comparison. And what Jesus is asking for here is this disregard, that there's a loyalty to him, that there's specifically a priority of love where those who don't follow Jesus, those who did follow Jesus against their family's wishes, imagine in the Middle East there were some who, when their family members started to follow Jesus, it was against the wishes of the family. And to the family, when somebody left the family to follow Jesus, it would feel like in that culture, if your identity, your wealth, your status, your entire future was associating with your family and you were to kind of leave the family to follow Jesus, do you know what it would feel like? You must hate us. And Jesus is saying that's what it will look like when somebody is a disciple. They will disregard their own life. But we tend to, especially here in the Western cultures, our faith kind of devotes itself to anything that's low cost, no cost, or no cost, low cost, right? We're inclined to look for biggest impact, most value, lowest amount of cost to ourselves, no or low cost following of Jesus. But there's a principle of sacrifice in growing in your faith that's required. And Jesus here is saying that someone who follows Jesus has to be willing to give up everything for Jesus. To teach this, Jesus uses this metaphor. And the metaphor he uses, it doesn't seem like a very effective form of evangelism. How many of you heard the phrase, when you're thinking about people sharing their faith, you remember, or maybe you've said, we've all kind of used it and said it at one time or other, maybe, which is, listen, I wanted to tell you a little bit about my faith. Here's what you need to know. That God loves you, and he's got a tremendous plan for your life. How many of you ever heard that phrase or used that phrase? Anybody? God loves you, and he has a great plan for your life. Jesus says something so different and so profoundly opposite of that, it's even shocking. Jesus says, you can't be my disciple unless you carry the painful loss. And he describes this cross. Basically, he says, I want you to know that God loves you, and you can't really follow Jesus unless you're willing to carry a cross of suffering and shame. Now, I've never tried that evangelism approach because my instincts tell me it's ineffective. Anybody else just feel like, I'm not sure I'm going to lead with that, right? And yet Jesus is telling the whole crowd, this is what followers will do. This is what the people who are really devoted to me and become a follower, this is what they do. Here's what he says in verse 27. And if you do not carry your own cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. What is he talking about? When he uses the word cross here, he's actually speaking about something that they would be familiar with. Because in the Roman Empire, when somebody was convicted of corporal punishment, when someone was getting the max sentence and was crucified, oftentimes what they would do with the convict is they'd give them their own cross, the cross beam of the cross, and on the way to being crucified, they would have to carry their own beam to the crucifixion sentence. And they would have to go right through the middle of the public square. And everybody would get to see the guilt and the shame and the suffering of somebody who is now publicly ashamed. So when Jesus talks about carrying your own cross, some commentators say, well, what that means is your own calling. Jesus' calling was to go to the cross and be crucified, and for him it meant death. But for others, it's whatever burden you have that you've been called to maybe help serve the poor, or maybe live a life of poverty, or whatever your calling is, that's your cross. But in the context here, people would know that when Jesus starts talking about a cross and shame and costliness, it would be associated with the people who are publicly ashamed and publicly suffering by carrying their own cross. And so imagine when people are like, what? What is he saying? What he's saying is that there is a willingness for any real follower of Jesus. There's a willingness to lose your life. There's a willingness to say that what I have and what I want and what I love is not as valuable to me. That I'm willing, in fact, to lose my deepest loves and desires, to suffer and to face suffering and shame. And to deny myself, to die to all my personal desires, that there's a willingness there. And Jesus said, without that willingness, people will give up. They will quit when it gets hard. They will quit when they're facing shame and suffering. They will quit when they lose the things that they cherished so desperately. That, in fact, the definition of faith, as Jesus describes it over time, is full confidence in him and someone who doesn't allow intruding loves to kind of steal or share their heart for Jesus, who is their hero and king and rescuer. So Jesus kind of condemns half-heartedness. We have a house full of kids, and we have to train them how to work, and we have to train them how to finish a job. It's amazing to me how kids, when they first get started working, will tell you things like, I'm all done with the job you gave me, and you go look at the job that you gave them, and you say, did you say you're all done, or you haven't started it yet? Because this doesn't look like you did anything at all. And there is this half-heartedness that we take oftentimes, even in our own faith. And Jesus is saying, I want to warn you against half-heartedness, because thriving, thrilling faith in following Jesus is going to require everything. It's going to require wholeheartedness, not half-heartedness. So when somebody gets stuck, I mean, you might be the kind of person who says, it's been a while. I'm not sure. When I heard that Jesus was talking about loving your enemies, I'm not really there. When Jesus was talking about forgiving people, I'm not really there. When Jesus says that believers, the church, or people who follow me are devoted to the outcast, the marginalized, the minimized, the widows, orphans, and otherwise people who are despised in culture, I'm not really there. When Jesus teaches that you don't just love people who love you back, you love your enemies, you might say, I'm not really there. What Jesus is saying is that it's possible, it's because you're trying to love everyone and everything along with Jesus. And he's saying that there's a priority where you say, when I'm your greatest treasure, that's when you really start to thrive and grow. And that's when you really start to see fruit in your own life, where you're willing to do anything. And for so many people, what's standing between a full devotion to Jesus and themselves is a romantic relationship, a fiance, a boyfriend or girlfriend, or a particular unhealthy devotion to success and profit and wealth and either approval or comfort or so on. And that, with the inability to let go of those things and to devote myself to loving Jesus, I end up doing what Jesus describes as having a house that's divided, or a heart that has many different masters to it. And Jesus is saying that simply isn't going to work. So what will work? What will work? If I'm unwilling to carry the cross, I'm clinging to a variety of loves, what's going to work? Now, because you're here at a kind of a gospel-centered church, we don't just talk in terms of what Jesus says or what God expects us that we ought to do, because the good news of the gospel is that the good news that tells you what you ought to do also provides the power to do it. So where do we get the power to do this? How many of you have noticed that it doesn't work to take notes on Sunday morning and then say, okay, so here's what I need to do. I need to carry my own cross. I need to be willing to accept suffering and shame, and be willing to give up everything I own, when should I do that? I'm going to say 9 o'clock Monday morning. Just jot it down, right? It's not a willpower question. It's, in fact, I have also noticed that it can't be a fake it till you make it effort. So where does the power come from to follow Jesus in this way? Where does the power come from to make these kinds of choices and to sacrifice what Jesus is saying to sacrifice? How do I do it? Here's where we start. If I've lost you up until now, here's the time to, you know, in the highway how there's on-ramps? This is the, get in the lane that's the on-ramp, and then let's come on back with me. We're going to get on right here. Listen to this. Here's what Jesus says. He basically says, treasure what you receive more than what you lose, okay? Except that Jesus is worth trusting and treasuring above all else. Once you see and believe, I like to say, Jesus teaches this, taste and see. Once you taste and see how good Jesus is and all that you have and all that you receive, then you are able to cherish and treasure Jesus more than anything that you lose or anything that you give up to get him or to have him. And what he provides for you, remember this, all the comfort and health and pleasure of this world is rubbish compared to him bringing you the forgiveness of the Creator. For the receiving of love and being adopted into his family and for eternal life, all that you get from Jesus is so much more valuable than anything that we lose to get Jesus or to follow Jesus. That what we receive when we receive Christ is everything that we receive from him causes all the other stuff, comfort, health, and pleasures of this world to look like, smell like, in comparison, rubbish. Having Jesus is more valuable than anything that I've lost to get him. Everything I get from Jesus is more precious than anything I give up for Jesus. Now, this is so vital. There's a shift in my heart. See, I go from unwilling to follow Jesus, unwilling to hate everyone and give up everything. I go from that to full devotion to Jesus at a certain moment when I discover that this cross that Jesus is asking me to carry, keep in mind, Jesus himself actually took the heavy cross, the cross of death, on himself for us, and then he gave us the light cross, the cross of suffering. Keep in mind that what Jesus has done for us should capture our affection because he carries the death cross and then gives us the lightweight suffering and shame cross to carry. So in essence, every time we remember during communion that we've got a broken body and shed blood, it should tell us and remind us that this is the heavy cross. It reminds me actually of when I was a teenager and I remember my dad saying to me, Dan, here's what we're going to do. I know that you're a teenager and you haven't learned to work yet, but we're going to put a wholehearted effort into moving this woodpile from here to here. And after trying to convince my dad that we didn't really need to move the woodpile, he decided that we did need to move the woodpile. And my dad was much older than most of other my friends' parents, and he absolutely busted it to move this woodpile from here to there. Meanwhile, I still remember this vividly. Every few pieces of wood I would move, I'd be like, Dad, I gotta take a break. Like, how long are we gonna do this? Forever? And he would say, like any father, till the job is done. And I would just be so cringing at the idea that we're going to work this whole time and I would need so much time off. It would seem so overwhelming to me. Only now as an adult do I realize my dad did all the heavy lifting. I didn't need any breaks. I was whining and complaining about my job. Meanwhile, he did the heavy lifting. This is what Jesus has done. He accepted your sin. The wages of sin is death, and he took upon himself our sins, became sin, so that you and I don't get the heavy cross of death and crucifixion. You and I get the light cross of suffering and the light cross of shame. And every time you and I bear our own cross in order to follow Jesus, never forget this isn't the heavy cross. This is the light cross. that in fact, all of the difficult cross-carrying, Jesus has already done it. All of the real suffering and real hurt and real damage Jesus took upon himself. He took upon himself the wrath of the Creator. It was poured on him, out on him. He absorbed it in our place so that you and I could have the little cross, so that you and I could enjoy the light burden of walking with and cherishing Jesus. The problem is that there are crossless Christians. And Jesus says these crossless Christians, they really do become a problem for the world. And more so than a problem, they become what he describes as useless. Crossless Christians, people who are unwilling to carry their own cross of suffering and shame or sacrifice, basically what Jesus says is that they're useless, that they're supposed to be out in the world making disciples. They're supposed to be adding flavor to the world. They're supposed to be representing God well and showing and demonstrating the beauty and the grace of God in the world. But when they're unwilling to sacrifice and unwilling to carry suffering and shame, they really aren't any different than anybody else. There is a uselessness. In verse 35, flavorless salt is good neither for the soil nor for the manure pile. It is thrown away. Christians who aren't salty are useless, and the people that are around them have no purpose for them, no use for them. They are not helpful. They don't necessarily represent God at all. And people who are around those kinds of Christians figuratively throw them out. They can't be used by God to bring flavor to the world. They don't experience their own identity as disciple makers and people who are fruitful in their spiritual maturity. They are unreplaceable. There's no plan B. If you've got salt and you want to add salt to something, but the salt isn't salty, where do you go to get the salt to taste like salt? There's no plan B. There is no replacement. And what Jesus is asking you to consider is this: inspect your trust. Who and what have you placed your trust in? What is it that has captured your heart? Who is it that has captured your heart? And what are the things that are standing in the way of you getting to know who Jesus is? By the way, isn't it true that you only trust someone who you know? The more you know someone, the more you're willing to trust them. It is impossible to put your trust in Jesus if you barely know him. Barely know him. Secondly, measure your treasure. It's so much easier to just talk about being devoted to Jesus than to actually sacrifice. But we should examine whether there are things that we're not willing to do. There are income thresholds I'm not willing to slip below. There are standards of living that I could not possibly imagine foregoing if it means devoting myself to Jesus and going wherever he takes me and following him wherever he goes. And what we're faced with is this: we embrace our own flavor. That disciples are salty. They bring God's flavor and preserve the fame of his great name by making disciples of Jesus. And we do so when we serve the hurting and we make disciples. And it requires us to abandon all of our loves and to, in comparison, despise all of the people and all of the things that belong to us figuratively with a willingness to do it. We envision in North Central Church more salty disciples. It's only the work of God that makes that possible. It's only the clear vision of who Jesus is that makes that possible.